but spiritualism answers for God and spirits both. The history of the universe reveals no precedent wherein 'tis shown that physical laws were ever turned aside for moral ones. The moral law which would have prompted tender friends, or loving guardian spirits, to have saved the mother and child from death, could not prevail against the storm's unyielding power which rendered their salvation all impossible. If spirits ever save their human charge from death or accident, some physical combination of favoring circumstances aids them, but without this, spirit no more can turn aside the whelming force of nature's eternal laws. God breaks not these himself, and yet we even claim of spirits what we dare not ask of God. We demand of our guardian angels what the infinite power that rules the universe cannot or does not do, namely, to infract his supremest laws. There is no change in them, and, therefore, such scenes as I describe, and such as all our memories will supply us with, whether they arise from accidents in nature, from the ignorance that places us in false relations with the elements, or from the willful infliction of suffering by men, all and each take place by the direct agency of God's eternal law. And the law of morals acts in one more direction, of which I shall speak tonight, and this is in the law of retribution. I have claimed that the martyrdoms of human nature addresses by EHP 88, are our best teachers. We all know that hunger, suffering, poverty, distress, and all the pains and penalties that toil and labor force on man, have been the motive powers for elaborating the genius of the race. Poet, artist, and musician have produced their sweetest music, painted their noblest gems of art, and written their finest epics beneath the stimulus of hard necessity. Sometimes, indeed, they have perished in their martyrdoms from out our midst, but they have left the noble tributes of their genius as evidence of the flowers that bloom in the bitter atmosphere of cruel pain, earth's stern but inexorable cultivator. Inventions, arts, and sciences have sprung from the suffering people. The non-producers, alas, having no need, have also little energy to labor. The intellectual wealth of history has, it is true, grown from out the ranks of those whom time and leisure compel, by the very martyrdom of indolence, and the pains and penalties of idle wealth, to labor in some direction. Even luxurious indolence becomes a burden, and so we have our Newtons, Herschels, and those whose minds can pause in contemplation and silent leisure on the wonders of creation. But, even then, the weariness of leisure is often the goad which prompts the mind to labor. Thus all the pains and penalties of life, whether in poverty or wealth, have elaborated themselves in the noblest works of art, the progress of science, and the gradual discovery of those realms of ever-widening natural beauty that only yield their revelations to the worker. But there is yet another kind of martyrdom, whose fruit we too must analyze. What of those who have labored in our midst and borne the shafts of bitter persecution? Such men as Mesmer, who gave to the world a priceless gift, and laid the foundation of the noblest science that ever yet has lit the ages, for mesmerism is the opening of the gates of spiritualism, the discovery of the mystery of life, and by the understanding of that mysterious power which Mesmer at last discovered to be identical with life, or vital magnetism, we have the key to the whole philosophy of ancient and modern miracles, and the telegraphic force of spiritual communion. And yet, when we ask how mankind has rewarded Mesmer, we have the old tale of base ingratitude, a life of persecution, a death of neglect, and poverty. And Mesmer's is the fate of thousands gone before, and feebly halting after him. Our city streets are full of such, the poets, who die for very want of bread, whom posterity will enshrine in useless bronze and marble, musicians, whose starved and hungry faces make our own grow pale to gaze at, haunting our path, beseeching bread, for the very notes we shall chant with immortal honors on their names when they are starved and dead. Kind heaven! Why we jostle our martyrs in the city streets each hour, and know them not. We see them go down to nameless graves, and ages hence the world shall all be changed, and the surface of society shall be alight with their resurrected genius. Regard the flame that meets your eye this night, the light that conquers darkness. What a glorious invention is this light! And yet, do you hear the shouting multitude giving honor and doing homage to him who discovered gas? Few even know his name. And such is the fate of Half-Life's unknown martyrs. Our only question then must be, since Earth denies them justice, what is the result upon their spirits in the great hereafter? I propose to answer this question in an allegory, by one of those word pictures by which the ancients used to signify a deeper meaning than the blunt rebuke or pointed individual appeal. Addresses by E.H.B., 89. They say that long ago a fair and tender wife died in the arms of the husband of her love. He had been her idol, the joy and star of life, her only earthly hope or thought or occupation. And when this tender wedded pair beheld the inevitable hour of doom that was to part them, their souls alike were torn with speechless anguish. She passed, and left her mourning love with all the light and joy of life departed. She carried with her to the spirit world naught but the memory of him whom she had loved. She stood, so says the fable which I quote, at the gates of paradise, a risen spirit, and, still deploring her lost love, sought for her place within the land of the blessed. But ere she entered, the judgment angel pointed to the book of life, and thereon she read recorded all the faults and unconsidered sins of her earthly life. There she beheld, with wonder and amazement, how very few, how small and scarcely worth the noting were the good deeds she had done. Poor idle careless child! They had not told her of the worth of life. She pleaded this, but it was all in vain. The stern, immutable moral law was on her. She must learn there was no royal road to heaven. She must live all of life in positive experience, actual practice. All her thought had been idolatry for her lost love, all her joy and earthly life had been knit up in him. To her all the world was naught beside. Now she must suffer, so the angel said, and a thousand years of penance were before her. Ere she entered upon the mournful doom of practice and instruction in her thousand years of fresh rudimental life, the still loving woman pleaded with the angel yet once more to return to earth and warn the idol that she had left, to whisper in his ear, and teach him how in mortal experiences to practice life, and strive to live so greatly better than herself, that he should not come into this place of torment. And the kind angel yielded to her prayer, and took her back to earth again. They sought the lover of her heart within the mansion she had lately left. He was not there. They passed into the groves where she had wandered with him hand in hand, in the blessed days of love. She knew he would be walking midst those shades, she said, in tender memory of his vanished joy, but still he was not there. Surely, she cried, we shall find him in the house of God, bending before the altar of religion, pleading for resignation to bear his loss of me. We shall find him where we knelt and prayed so oft together. Take me there. The angel, yielding to her pleading, led her to the altar, and there indeed they found her loved one, but not in supplication for the lost dead wife, nor yet in prayerful mourning for her loss. He stood beside a fair young girl repeating the marriage rite, and placing on her hand the ring of the dead wife. In the deep and burning agony of woe that pressed on the poor spirit, she turned to the guardian angel and bade him take her hence, take her to doom, take her to torture, take her to any penalty. Naught now was too hard to bear. Her heart's love wrecked, all was wrecked. No doom of burning pain nor agonizing torture would be penance now to the wrung and broken spirit. But, turning from the path of doom to paradise, the pitying angel cried, come home, come home. Poor spirit, come with me, come to thy paradise. Thy penalty is paid, thy penance done, thy free soul purified. For in the deep unfathomable anguish of one dreadful moment, in the single sand grain of an hour, when all life's bitterest martyrdoms are crowded in one point, thy thousand years of penalty is paid. And in this allegory I tell you the history of the martyr in the world of spirits. In this I have told you the effect of martyrdom upon the human soul. It is ever so, in spirit land, there is no time or space. We only mark the dial by our heart throbs, we only know the movements of creation by the emotions of our souls. There we may live in one short moment of agony for centuries, and so in the few consuming hours of torture wherein the human form is racked with a martyr's suffering, in the few addresses by E.H.B. 90, dreadful moments that destroy the blazing body, in the pain of long imprisonment, or the quickened heart throbs of bitter grief with which we suffer man's ingratitude, in the wretchedness of woe which consumes in silent anguish so many breaking hearts, in every pain and penalty of life there is a moral transmutation in our souls, a glorious transfiguration that makes the doom of martyrdom the gate of purgatory through which we pass to paradise. You still may question this assertion because we cannot prove it, because it is not in your experience. But have you stood in the presence of earth's martyrs, returned again to earth at the spirit circle? Question one of these, question of those who in the agony of drowning have beheld all memories of life, all its event and with it all its judgments crowded upon them, think you there is no transmutation there? Think you that when we behold the page of cause and effect mapped out before us we do not comprehend far better than in the darkness, in which we are now groping, why we have erred, and how to make atonement? And in this knowledge we are transfigured. There is no real time in spirit life, as we define it, and whilst therefore we do not excuse the hand that strikes the blow, whilst we have no extenuation to offer for those who make earth's martyrs, still the pain inflicted by whatever cause is purifying in its action. The spirit vision opened us with the drowning man to the page of cause and effect. The spirit sits in judgment upon himself, his book of life is opened, but especially in the tortures of martyrdom, the transfigured spirit comes out of the fearful crucible of pain, instructed in a spiritual point of time in a whole life's penalty of action. Thus much for the martyrs, but for their persecutors, remember that, though offences must come, woe unto those by whom the offence cometh. I would rather say, God help the men that make the martyrs, than God help the martyrs, they have more need of prayer. Every living creature that is in the hand of God is safe. Every living soul that places itself in harmony after its best knowledge morally or physically with the infinite is safe. We may by ignorance become the victims of physical law, but in the martyrdom with which we pass from earth in some agonizing form of death, in the few moments or hours, weeks, months, or years, in which we endure the pains of martyrdom, we are in the fire of purification. We are in the great crucible of pain, and he, the eternal alchemist, is preparing to produce from this the thrice refined gold. But not so of those that do inflict the pain, woe, woe to them. If there is an inevitable result of the moral law that purifies the soul through suffering, so there is an inevitable result of the moral law that reacts upon those who inflict the suffering. Oh! Let us take heed to this and reflect upon it. Pause, spiritualists, before the spirit circle, and question of the martyrs what is their condition. Question of those who have passed through great fires of tribulation. We may not, with illuminated eyes, perceive the angel light upon their brows, but it is surely there. It shines on many an obscure form, on many a broken-hearted wife, a toiling child, a patient unrequited drudge, and many an humble being who lives and dies unknown, toiling away in dim obscurity the precious soil of life from mortal recognition, finding no sympathy, no pity, no help nor hope on earth. How many martyrs move around us now, bearing this bitter cross? We may pity as we hear the tale of martyrdom, but oh, the glorious transfiguration of the hour of death. Have you ever thought why the man of sorrows, despised and rejected of men, a houseless wanderer, without where to lay his head, should appear to the eyes of his amazed disciples in the moment of transfiguration, a being so gloriously bright they wist not what they said? Was not this the effect of the change from the mortal sufferer to the spiritual conqueror? Was not this the picture of a sorrowing earthly soul, shorn of its mask of earth, and shining in the glorious radiance of a spiritual life? Addresses by E.H.B. 91. This is the glorious representation of the effect of earthly life and its pains and penalties appearing upon the purified spirit. And it does not take years, nor even hours, to effect these changes. It is enough that we suffer, endure, and realize the judgment without ourselves, whether in a minute or in a life. It is enough that in that judgment all the causes and effects of crime are judged within us, we spring up free from that judgment bright and purified. No need to come back to earth for reincarnation. There are spheres enough in spirit life to afford us all of progress, knowledge, and experience that we shall need, even those whose career has been violently cut off, whose earthly mission seems to be destroyed and snapped in twain. It is not a question of time how they shall work that broken mission out, it is only a question of soul experience, and whether it be the life of an hour for the babe, or the life of the century for the old man, so long as the soul is associated with matter here, it obtains all that the earth need give, all that material life can render. And beyond the boundaries of this life are all the experiences necessary for the full elaboration of that soul's progress, especially, as I have shown you, in the transition of the suffering spirit through the dreadful gates of martyrdom. It may be a consolation even to some amongst yourselves to analyze the deep and sublime philosophy of martyrdom, and consider the stern, but wise and just character of physical laws, to speculate on the soul experiences of those who may have perished in some vast catastrophe. When you have familiarized yourselves with spiritual revelations and spiritual conditions, you will know that martyrdom is not in vain, that lives are not snapped in twain outside of law, that no laws of God are broken, but all are ultimated and carried out, even in that worst and darkest problem of existence which we call martyrdom. Souls of the martyrs, shades of the heroes, bright and glorious forms of earth's patriots, brave reformers, noble sufferers and mighty teachers. If we have dared to draw aside the veil this night that hides thy shining forms from the eye of man, thou best knowest that thine inspiration has been the coal of fire that is placed upon these lips. Thou best knowest that it has been for earth to ask of thee, and that thou, through earthly lips, have rendered back the answer. Perhaps there are many of earth's best and dearest yet to follow in the path of martyrdom, perhaps there are some about us treading even now the hill to Calvary. Oh, may the lesson of this hour be with them in the darkness and the gloom, may they remember not alone the glorious liberty in which the martyred soul goes free, but may they ever feel in their bitter hour of trial that thou art pouring on this earth thine inspiration, and teaching us the uses of the bright and glorious mission which pain and suffering bring to men, then thou wilt not have died in vain, and, if by thy bright example, by thy holy teaching, by the revelation of thy transfiguration from earth's darkness to the light of paradise, we may be strengthened in our hour of trial, martyrdom for thee, and us will not have been in vain. Addresses by E.H.B. 92, questions answered extempore by Miss Emma Harding at the Winter Soirees, Harley Street, London, March 19th, 1866 Question 1. It is alleged by most mediums that there are times when a suspension of the medium power occurs. Will you explain the law which governs mediumship in this particular? Answer. Right. He is alleged by some naturalists that electricity is essential to the growth of the vegetable world, and that in the springtime when the processes of growth are most active, that the demand for this life element is great, and no surplus exists to produce storms of thunder and lightning. Pursuing this train of reasoning still further, it is added, that in the fall of the year when the processes of growth are ended, and those of decay in the vegetable world have supervened, the surplus of the unappropriated charge of electric life in the atmosphere is manifested in the form of the numerous thunderstorms so prevalent in the season of autumn. The same law that pervades the universe and manifests itself wherever electrical phenomena are displayed, attaches also to the human form, though with less definite periodicity. There is no existence throughout the realm of nature so apparently uncertain as the human form, because, being a compendium of all the forces in nature, it is subject to a greater variety of influences. Nevertheless, the laws that affect it are the same as those of the whole realm of nature. It is in the absence of a surplus amount of the electrical force, that medium power is ever suspended. It is when there is an excess of this force that medium power is in operation. Those persons who possess by nature great excess of electrical force are never subject to the total suspension of mediumistic power, however much the degree of that force may vary. There is a variety but never a total loss of it, and it is healthful to practice mediumship, from the fact that if such an excess is permitted to accumulate, it would manifest itself in the wild, erratic, and constant tendency to movement, that is always observed in the young of all creatures in whom there is a vast charge of what we call vaguely the life principle, but what should more correctly be termed electrical force. In the young of all creatures who are largely supplied with this force, nature wisely disposes of the surplus by an amount of involuntary activity that would wear out the set form of the adult. In conditions of suffering and disease also, you will find that persons who have manifested no medium power while enjoying the full play of health, are frequently the subjects of clairvoyance and mesmeric phenomena, such as trance, vision, dreams, somnambulism, and other phases of spiritualistic and mediumistic power. Why is addresses by E.H.B. 93 this? Not because the abnormal condition of disease is absolutely more favorable to mediumistic development than the normal state of health, but because the life principle which should be concentrated and distributed equally throughout the system is too rapidly parted with, from the very face of disease, and because the system has not a sufficiently concentrated force to retain it. As it is this life principle which forms the force or power which constitutes mediumship, the state of disease which gives off this force in excess, is of course favorable though not essential to mediumship. Now, all the varieties which appear in mediumistic powers result from changes in the organism and the action of physical laws producing varieties of physical states. The same varieties may be produced by changes in the atmosphere, the surroundings, or even the diet, mental state, associations, or physical conditions of the medium. We can lay down no precise analysis of conditions favorable or otherwise for mediumistic phenomena, from the fact that everything which affects the medium, affects the power, and changes the genius of life and temperament. Nevertheless, we may define generally favorable conditions, classify and group temperaments, and in the varieties of groups, we find one class who never lose even temporarily their mediumship, although its force varies, another who only manifest it in conditions of physical suffering, yet another class who only exhibit it at special times and under special conditions of atmosphere and surroundings. There is a science in the production of all mediumistic manifestations, the study of which can alone render the erratic nature of the phenomena comprehensible. We should be happy to enlarge upon this subject should further questions be demanded in reference to it. Question 2. What is the connection, if any, between hysteria and mediumship? Answer. Hysteria is a nervous affection common to persons of a highly susceptible temperament. As its seat is not unfrequently found in special nerves which physiologically speaking are peculiar to the feminine organism, and as mediumship is more frequently developed in the finely strung and susceptible physique of woman than the more indurated frame of man, so hysteria, which is produced by a highly susceptible condition of the nervous system unduly stimulated by excitement, is frequently supposed to be connected with mediumship, and that only because both states are liable to affect the same subjects. Hysteria and mediumship are not necessarily connected with each other, but both become manifest under certain conditions in the same person, and those who are highly sensitive to the influence which produces mediumship are the most likely to be affected with the disease hysteria. There are many curious psychological and physiological facts related to each other which careful observation of the phenomena of magnetism and catalepsy, somnambulism and hysteria, mediumship and nerve aura, together with other mental and physical states strangely interblended with each other would serve to illustrate. Affections of the throat and glandular diseases generally, are often found to coexist with the occult powers of mediumship, clairvoyance, and somnambulism, at the same time that they can by no means be regarded either as their cause or effect. I would say that those highly strung physiques generally, which by reason of their peculiarly addresses by E.H.B. 94, nervous temperament are the subjects of one of these states, become liable from the nature of such a temperament to all and each of the other manifestations of nervous affections, and the relation between them is simply that which exists between fire heat, force movement, soothing and agitating influences, all and each varying phenomena of which can be called forth from the same electromagnetic apparatus, under different conditions of its powers. Question 3. Will you explain to us the origin of language? Are the element forms which we term roots mere abstractions? Are they imitations of the sounds of nature, or are they formed in obedience to some law by which sound becomes a fitting expression, first, of the outer, and then figuratively or correspondentially of the inner life of man? Answer: the whole of these questions involve separate points. The first of these, concerning the origin of language, we shall treat as first in order. You will all have remarked who have observed the habits of savage life, that the earliest attempt which man in his primitive state of being makes to express himself is by gesture, especially in those who manifest the nearest approach to what we may call an aboriginal state, as in the savages of Australasia and Central America. We find there is an invariable difficulty to teach such persons to articulate words clearly. In fact, the utterances of the most savage nations scarcely exceed low guttural sounds. As men advance into higher states of civilization, we find marked evidence of an improvement in their powers of speech, a diminution of their redundancy of gesture, and a clearer utterance through the improvement which the practice of speech produces in their vocal organs and capacity for articulation. Again, in the earliest forms of language or speech, we find that the tendency of man is to express himself in monosyllables. In a people who hold little or no intercourse with their fellow men, and who are therefore unprogressive, language is mainly confined to monosyllables, as amongst the modern Chinese, and some others of the Mongolian tribes. Amongst this conservative people, language now, as thousands of years ago, consists principally of monosyllables. On the contrary, in an old, and probably a decaying race, like the Red Indians, a race which has been, but is now unmistakably and inevitably passing away, this people, still retaining their ancient traditions and habits, and even the shadowy memories of all that their prime has once witnessed, use a compound and highly synthetic language. The Indian dialects, varied as they are in different tribes, are so full of ideality, and so redundant in their attempts at expression, that no language upon earth is more instructive in deduction concerning the past history of the people who make use of it. Physiologically speaking, speech may be regarded first as one of the strongest lines of demarcation between the animal and the man; next, when the spine, instead of running laterally along the ground, as in the animal, becomes erect, as in man, and there is a freer expression for the air which passes through its proper conduits, it is evident that this change of attitude is instrumental in its effect upon the vocal organs. Again, as the mind becomes impressed with many ideas, and great varieties of objects, as in conditions of civilization, are presented to the intellect, requiring many words to address is by EHB 95, represent them, mobility of speech, and a corresponding improvement in tone, is invariably manifest in the expression or clothing for the ideas which language affords. Hence, as the inevitable expression of the intellect, speech must be proportioned first to the formation of the vocal organs, next, to the mental stimulus that moves those organs, next, to practice in variety and mobility of words, and, finally, to a near cultivated by listening to varieties of sounds from others. Now, whilst we believe that speech is the peculiar gift of humanity, we notice that all creatures have a mode of communication with their kind. Some means of communion exist even amongst the humblest of creatures, as in the insect, reptile, fish, and amongst birds. All creatures hold intercourse with each other, and the higher the animal kingdom ascends, the more surely does their mode of communication become obvious, improve in intelligence, and tend towards the utterance of sounds. Hence the culminating point of nature's efforts at expression are found in the varied tones of the human voice, while the highest expression of civilization is a diffuse and synthetic language. Speech, which must be necessarily imperfect in the child race, ever improves as it tends onward to the manhood of time. Nevertheless, when we investigate, through the study of philology, the various families or groups into which the languages of Earth have been classed, we find much reason for assigning to them a common origin. Even in the ancient Sanskrit, a tongue very full, complete, and redundant, we have abundance of proof that the roots of the language have strong affinity with the modern English, while the monosyllabic Chinese and the compounded American Indian, both are strikingly different in grammatical structure as opposite points of the compass, still give evidence of a decided affinity in their roots or origin.